Good evening, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Bog, live every single Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern here on DLive.tv/Dave Martell. You can also go over to the Dave Martell YouTube channel, like, subscribe, share over there, and check out all of our episodes uploaded there. We got all of our archives over there, and also we could very possibly be moving up here very soon, but not quite yet, so that's in the future. Also, make sure you get your copy of Episys 2, man. Episys Magazine Issue 2, it's available on Amazon. Just go to Amazon.com, type in Episys Magazine, and it'll come right up, and because up here, in a, what is it, a week, 2 weeks, June 20th, Episys number 3 will be out, and you guys are really going to love it. It's going to be great. So many articles from so many brilliant people. It's our best issue yet. You guys are going to love it. But anyway, without further ado, tonight our guest is Mike from the Imperium Press, and he's here to talk to us about Proto-Indo-European Reconstructionism, ancestor worship. He's going to tell us a little bit about his press, but we're going to talk about a lot of theology and all kinds of interesting stuff. Really interesting guy. So welcome to the bog, Mr. Mike.
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. So
that intro, by the way, is just fucking amazing. I've got to say,
it's really the best one in any of the podcasts we've ever seen. It's great.
Oh, yeah,
for sure.
Oh yeah, shout out to Lighty Decay. The best intro.
He does the best work.
The best work. He's brilliant. So
he's also responsible for Arya Akasha's main infographic there.
Oh,
absolutely great work.
Yeah, he's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. So let's get right into it. Mr. Mike, I know you didn't want to talk too much about Imperium Press, but at least let's do a little brief overview about what Imperium Press is and where people can find it, and then we can get into all of the theology stuff that we want to talk about, because I want to make sure I give you guys a plug and people can go check it out.
For sure. Oh, well, thanks. So yeah, it's a publishing company started in 2018. It's just so everybody knows, the website is imperiumpress.org. Not .com, it's imperiumpress.org. So yeah, have a look. There's quite a bit there. I started it in 2018 because basically I like to read old books, and I just got sick of seeing them framed in ways that are just totally shitty, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
If I'm being blunt about it. So the beginning of it was when I read an edition of Nietzsche. I think it was Beyond Good and Evil. I think if I'm just going to call it out, it's the Cambridge University Press edition, the green cover. And it the intro underscored his reactionary tendencies in terms that were completely unsympathetic and were just like, look, this is okay. Like, you got to put all this reactionary stuff aside and just sort of look at it for, like, if you subtract the reactionary tendencies from Nietzsche, it's like, what do you have left, pretty much?
Yeah.
So anyway, I read that, and it's like, I was, you know, I've been reading Nietzsche for years, and I just got this like other version of Beyond Good and Evil. And I was like, just instantly put a sour taste into my mouth. And then later on, I read an edition of a guy by the name of Jean Bodin, B-O-D-I-N. He's an old absolute monarchist theorist. And it basically, and this is even worse, it just basically said on the cover straight out, like, look, he's wrong. And, you know, don't read this book, basically, right? It's like, he's only interesting as a historical curiosity. You just need to understand him to understand other things, and not as a thinker in his own right. And it's like, that's just, that people shouldn't be publishing if that's what they're doing, you know?
Yeah.
So I just looked around, and I tried to find somebody that was like doing what it is that we are now doing. And I just couldn't find anybody. And that is like publishing and repackaging old books in ways that are actually trying to be sympathetic to them and understand them in their own terms for what they are. And that's when I realized that something needed to be done. Somebody needed to do this. So that's kind of how it all started. And I really hope that other people follow suit in other fields and things like literature and music and movies, because definitely like our side of things, our guys, you know, we need our own sort of network on these things.
Absolutely. So one thing that you wanted to talk about tonight, and this is something I find very interesting, is we all know Tristan finds interesting because this is pretty much what he does over at Arya Akasha with the Indo-European research that they do. But you are a proto-Indo-European reconstructionist, am I right?
That's right, yeah.
Could you tell us how you came about being a proto-Indo-European Reconstructionist, and what does it entail, and just kind of give us an overview of it.
So proto-Indo-European Reconstruction is kind of like you decided one day, you're like, man, I'm just sitting around and I'm not really in like great shape, but I think I should get into shape. You know what I'm going to do? The first thing I'm going to do, I'm going to go try and climb Mount Everest. I'm just going to do the hardest thing that I could possibly do. Yeah. Just the climb the biggest fucking hill that is out
there.
The
old sink or swim mindset.
Yeah, exactly. Because believe me, like being a proto-Indo-European Reconstructionist is like, I can't think of something that's really much more of a challenge, right? Because what you're trying to do, you're trying to reconstruct the worldview and the theology and the praxis of these people who lived 5,000 years ago, 5,000-6,000 years ago, and didn't write anything. So it's, that has to be done in very, very careful ways. And with
Not only did they not write anything, but for the majority of their existence, they lived before writing was ever invented. No one was writing anything.
Exactly. So not only did they not write anything, but you don't even have any like secondary sources on them or anything at all like that. So it's a bit of a challenge. As for how I came to it, honestly, I don't know. It's hard. I have to sort of like really think back. I've always had an interest in theology. My parents, this is just this old story that I'm going to tell. When I was a kid, just like everybody, your parents ask you like, what do you want to be when you grow up? You know, it's like, well, maybe I want to be a police officer, or I want to be a fireman, or I want to be a baseball player, whatever. My answer to that question was, I want to be a druid. That was my career ambition back in the day, like when I was about like 7 or 8 years old. And I can't really tell you why. But definitely,
that must have been a very sad conversation.
No, my dad still tells it to this day because he finds it's like the funniest thing in the world to him. He still loves it. So that's kind of, I've always had a sympathy to religion in general and all religions. I mean, I've studied quite a few of them in depth but particularly the pre-Christian European religions, paganisms, I guess we could call them, has been always sort of near and dear to my heart. And it's for reasons I can't quite explain. It's just something that you feel in your gut, even before I really knew much about them at all. Spent a long time sort of, I've read the old New Testaments many, many times. I have respect for Christian religion, but it just wasn't for me. So I'm sort of casting about, came to Taoism of all things for a while. And that's something that's still near and dear to me, but it's a little bit too transcendent for my taste now. One of the things about Taoism that I picked up from that was actually what's called differential ontology, which is the idea that things exist in virtue of being different from other things, which is kind of a deep like metaphysical concept. And the more I read, the more I sort of realized that that's something that the sort of dualism, or if not dualism, then a pluralism, is something that's kind of at the heart of a lot of polytheisms. And sure. It's also very much at the heart of Indo-European theology, and we can talk a little bit about that. There's all kinds of couplings and twins and trilogies, yeah, and triumvirates and everything like that. And eventually sort of through a long, political development, came to the idea that basically it's all about praxis over doctrine, basically. And when you look at the Indo-European religions, the paganisms, you find that they're incredibly orthopraxic. They're not quite – the orthodoxy is not as strong with them as it is with, say, Judaism or Christianity. Those are very orthodox religions. They have a doctrine and beliefs and things that, like, if you don't believe this, basically you are not a Christian, or you can't be a Jew or whatever – And that's not to say that, you know, pagans don't have beliefs, but I think the emphasis is more on praxis over theory. And that's something that I really sort of came to believe that's important. And long story short, the more I looked into the Indo-Europeans, the more it seems like that's sort of at the heart of what they're all about.
Yeah, I mean, there are some very resonant themes in Taoism that you can pick up through all the Indo-European religions. We talk about it all the time in the Norona Society, maybe not explicitly Taoism, but some of the themes I'll pick up here that, for instance, Dave, you probably don't realize, but Taoism is very focused upon an appreciation for natural law and the law of the divine, what is harmonized in nature and what is the rules embedded within nature. And as you can see there, that's very connected to what we do here in the Norona Society and the theology of our faith.
Yeah. I mean, the Taoism is essentially, the Tao is essentially Dharma. It's like literally all about Dharma.
Yeah, the Tao is, it's an interesting concept because it is sort of the precondition of any, it's really one of the deepest concepts that anyone has ever sort of come up with, because it's sort of the way the world is. Like, the world is nothing more than the way the world is. That's the way that I see the concept of the Tao, because the literal meaning of Tao is way, right? And it means way in the same manner that we mean it. It's like it could be a way, like a path that you take from A to B. It's the way from, you know, here to there. It's also the way as in like the way things are, and it's a way as in a way of life. It's just, it's got all those connotations. And what it is essentially is it's sort of the precondition for anything to exist. For anything to exist, it has to partake in Tao. So in some ways, I actually see it as resonant with the Hindu concept of Brahman. It's very, very sort of barking up the same tree, I would say.
Yeah.
Oh, I would say it's very similar.
Taoism is essentially monism.
It is, but it's a dialectical monism, and that's the interesting thing about it. And by dialectical monism, what I mean is you've got a whole, but the whole expresses itself as at least a bipartite division. So I think it's chapter 2 of the Tao Te Ching is the one where it basically says you can't have up without down, you can't have left without right, you can't have short without long, tall without small. You can't have anything that exists necessarily expresses itself in these sort of like antinomies, these opposites. So it's the unity of opposites. And in some ways, it's very, very resonant with even some of the like ancient Greeks, like Heraclitus, which is a heavy duty, you know, pre-Socratic philosopher that I got really, really into for a long time. Pre-Socratics are really interesting. And Heraclitus is very, very similar to, he has a lot of Eastern themes in his philosophy. He's very focused on impermanence as well, which is something near and dear to the Tao.
Oh, you see, that's rather interesting. We could connect that right into the Indo-European reconstruction. I wouldn't say that the pre-Socratics have necessarily Eastern themes. It's just that they have Indo-European themes that have commonly risen to the surface. You know, the pre-Socratic philosophers record a lot of the beliefs and values of the Hellenic faith before it became, you know, like cast off to the side or forgotten a lot, and it was retaken up by Platonism.
Yeah, they represent an interesting development in Greek history. And I would recommend to anyone who's interested in this topic to read a book called The Ancient City that we published, but it's, you know, it's available for free. We're giving everything away for free on our website. But I mean, what we do is we publish old books. This one's from like 1872 or something. So, you know, you can get it online for free anywhere. Anyway, it explains the development of the classical world from both Roman and Greek, from ancient Indo-European times down to basically the advent of Christianity. And one of the things that it explains is that philosophy is a sort of it's a watermark. It's a very important sort of landmark in that development, and it's a very late one. And definitely the development of philosophy, the pre-Socratics, is a very, very important sort of development from Indo-European times on down. In some ways, it really does sort of resonate like as a mirror image of the ancient sort of stratum of like theological background. But in some ways also it's a radical departure from it it's obviously like Greek philosophy is a sort of turning point for Western culture. In some ways, very, very interesting and fruitful, but in some ways actually quite destructive as well.
So going back to Proto-Indo-European Reconstructionism, there are a lot of people out there, not a lot, but there's a decent amount of people out there that call themselves Proto-Indo-European Reconstructionists. And I kind of, the criticism of Proto-Indo-European Reconstructionism is something that you mentioned earlier. Like, these are people that existed before writing was a thing. Nothing was written down. There's some material culture that we know about. We know about, obviously, like the Yamnaya pit grave culture. We know about, we know about that they existed. We don't have anything about how they practiced, what they worshipped, stuff like that. How do you have a meaningful relationship with these deities if you don't even really know who the deities were?
Yeah, so I mean that's an excellent question, and really it's the question that needs answering in Proto-Indo-European Reconstruction and theology. What we should be clear about when we're talking about the Indo-European, I'll just call them the Indo-Europeans, and have that mean Proto-Indo-Europeans.
Hi, guys.
Yeah, yeah. So we should be clear that what we're talking about here is not just one people that existed at a particular time and place. We're talking about a complex of cultures that existed over a period of thousands of years, probably 2,000 years. So what are we talking about when we're talking about Indo-Europeans? Are we talking about, like you said, the Yamnaya culture? Are we talking about the Srednistog? Are we talking about the Andronovo? Are we talking about the corded ware culture? And so on and so on.
Well, weren't corded ware, they were Neolithic farmers.
They were later, right? Yeah. I think corded ware, as far as I know, corded ware was the migration that happened sort of at the very end of the Proto-Indo-European I'm thinking that they're the ones that sort of like branched off into Northern Europe, but I could be wrong about
that. Either way, I'm sorry. Carry on.
Yeah, yeah. This is a complex of cultures. Quite a few people over a wide area and a long period of time. So it's not just a sort of unitary block, but within that block, there are definite sort of themes that sort of run through it, and I would say that the most important theme, the chord that emerges from all the disparate notes that you get from Reconstruction is the ancestor cult. And I guess I should probably talk for a sec about how we can sort of even understand or know what these people thought or believed when they didn't leave any records at all. And the way that that's done is through the comparative method. Now, this is something that's been used in quite a few different fields. Probably the main field, the one that sort of gets the most attention, is linguistics. And that has been quite a remarkable feat. If you can imagine, reconstructing a vocabulary of hundreds of words and a variety of concepts from people who didn't write anything, that seems like magic, to be quite honest. And it is quite an intensive process. So without going into like too much of the linguistics, basically what this guy named William Jones realized back in the 18th century is that there's an amazing sort of correspondence between a few different languages that nobody thought were related. And those are the European languages, Roman, Greek, Old Norse, and some of the Near Eastern languages, not so much Near Eastern, but the ancient Iranian language. And then he discovered, he was actually posted out in India as a sort of legal magistrate presiding over a trading company, that actually Sanskrit has some amazing, amazing correspondences with English and Iranian and Greek and Rome and Latin. And he, long story short, basically over the about 150 years after that, people slowly but surely were able to reconstruct a vocabulary, a common vocabulary that sort of takes, it was obviously at the root of all of these different languages. And people used to think that, you know, India was just like the perfect example of an exotic culture with nothing to do with Europeans at all. But then it turns out that we share a common linguistic ancestor. So yeah, the comparative method, basically the way that it works is there are sound changes that happen as languages change through time. And it just so happens that these sound changes are completely predictable. And so basically what you can do is you can take old, like current languages and sort of play them backwards to sort of reconstruct the ancestor language. And that's what they've done. They've been able to reconstruct the Proto-Indo-European language, which is quite an amazing feat. Mm-hmm. But this has also been done with other in other fields as well. It's been done with comparative mythology, for example. Like we're able to recount a Proto-Indo-European creation myth. And this is something more than just a very bare bones story. It's actually, you know, goes through some developments, which is quite an amazing feat in itself. So the comparative method is one way that we can reconstruct these things. But the thing that seems to be at the bottom of it all, the sort of like common denominator for all of it, is the ancestor cult. And that's something to come back to your original question, Dave, which is how can you have a personal relationship with these deities that people hadn't spoken their names for, you know, thousands of years? Mm-hmm. Well, the way that you can do that is by venerating your ancestors, which is exactly what people did, you know, 5,000 years ago in the Pontic Caspian steppe.
So give us a little bit of a rundown. Now we do know that the Indo-Europeans had deities. We do know that they were polytheists. You know, we can there's people go so as far as, like, for example, we know the general functions of the deities in the, like, you mentioned something about twins and stuff. Like, we know that they had, there was like a horse twin cult. We know that they had Sky Father, Earth Mother, so on and so forth. We have all of these functions.
The Thunder Striker.
The Thunderer. Yeah. So we have all of these different functions. There's some folks out there that go as far as giving them names, like what is the Thunderer?
Yeah, the Thunderstark Striker was called Perkwunos, at least as far as we can reconstruct.
Now, how accurate, Mike, do you think that is? Do you think his name actually was Perkwunos? And also, if it wasn't, do you think that's still a meaningful way to go about worshiping Perkwunos?
Yes, I do, actually. That's to answer your first question, how sure are we about this? We're pretty damn sure. It's one of the more secure things that we know about the Proto-Indo-Europeans at all, including material culture. I think some archaeologists would take issue with that, but I think that it's probably true. Even most archaeologists would agree that we can...
At least 98%. And if it is different, then it's probably like some weird, like, slight letter or pronunciation difference. And it's 98% solid.
Some sort of laryngeal that we forgot about, like, you know, 3,000 years ago or whatever. But we're pretty damn sure about it, because linguistic reconstruction is very, very secure. And to the degree that we can even say things about, like, what happened to these deities over time. Like, so one of them, for example, is Dios, which is the sort of linguistic root behind the name Zeus, but also Jupiter as well, because if you the ancient sort of archaic Latin name for Jupiter was Zeus Pitter, which if you kind of run it together sounds like Zeus Pitter. It sounds like Jupiter. That's where you get that. That this name has it was originally Zeus, which means shining father, Zeus Pitar. And what we can say about this deity, just through some sort of arcane linguistic reconstruction, is that over time, this deity became sort of more and more transcendent, more and more sort of like the highest, most transcendent god that there is in the pantheon. And over time, it just this Dios deity became more and more remote. to the degree that they just kind of forgot about him, actually. And he no longer received worship. And then over time, through the migrations and development, historical developments of these people, he actually kind of became run together with the Thunderer, the Perkwunos that we were talking about. And the aspects of the Thunderer kind of took on the name of Zeus. So now we've got Zeus, who's the thunder god that strikes with a lightning bolt, and Jupiter as well. So we can say something even about the development of these deities over time. I think it's absolutely, well, not absolutely certain, but it's as certain as we need to be able to say that we know things about these deities.
Fascinating.
So right, we can also reconstruct some common myths, such as the slaying of the serpent from the Thunder Striker.
That's right. Yeah, like I was saying, the Proto-Indo-European creation myth itself can actually be recounted. So if we want to just go through it real quick, it's just at the beginning of time, there were two brothers, and these were, we even have names for them. One of them was named Manu, that's man, and the other one was named Yimo, which is twin, right? And so man and twin, they travel through the universe with this cosmic cow. This is going to sound very, very familiar, I'm sure. They travel through the universe with this cosmic cow, and then decide that they're going to create the world. So in order to do this, man, that is Manu, has to sacrifice twin, that is Yimo. Sometimes it's the cow that he sacrifices. And so man takes the parts of twin's body, and with the help of the sky gods, he makes them into different parts of the world. So he makes them into the, you know, the fire and earth and sun and moon and sea and wind. And man, after sacrificing his brothers, takes up his role as cosmic priest. And here comes the part that Tristan was just talking about. So eventually, the gods give the cattle to a third man comes into the picture. His name's Trito. But a three-headed, six-eyed serpent named Nigui steals the cattle. And Nigui is, we get the, that's actually the root of our word negation or negative. So third man, whose cattle has been stolen by the serpent, appeals to the storm god, Perkwunos, to help him recover the cattle. And so third man and the storm god, or Trito, I guess we should say, goes to the with the storm god, goes to the lair of the serpent, kills it, takes back the cattle, and gives the cattle to man, Manu, the priest, to continue the sacrifices. And then third man, Trito, takes up his position as warrior, as Kshatriya, essentially. So, I mean, for a theological complex that's been dead and gone for 3,000 years at least, that's quite a an intensive myth that we can recount. So
impressive, yeah. There's
quite a lot that we can say about these people. I think that we have to be very, very careful, because you can easily read in a lot of bullshit and just sort of make things up as you go along, which yeah. You don't want to do, because that's, you know, obviously completely sacrilegious, but there's a lot that we can say, a lot that we can be quite sure about.
Yeah, and that creation myth you mentioned, there's so many elements that are completely identical to Voluspa. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned about the cow, Althumla. You mentioned about taking the body, turning it into the world, the three men.
Even the name of the twin, Yimo. I mean, does that sound familiar or what?
It sounds like Ymir, yeah. Incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible. So, how do you, now that we know that, you know, I mean, the reconstruction of these ancient practices, these ancient theology is pretty sound, how do you go about making that an actual practice? I mean, you mentioned earlier that you're absolutely right that, at least in ancient times anyways, our ancestral practice was very much more praxis-based. It was an orthopraxy as opposed to an orthodoxy. So how do you implement this theology into your life? How do you put it into practice, and how do you put it into ritual?
For sure. Yeah, no, I'll definitely we'll talk about that. I do want to actually sort of just dilate very quickly here on the orthopraxy versus orthodoxy thing, because I think this is something that you pick up in pagan circles, and it's something that pagans catch flack for, which is kind of being these sort of woolly, soft kind of I do what I want kind of thing, you know, like yeah. There's a lot of pagans out there, and it's a valid criticism that we get from Christians that are kind of like, don't tell me what to do. You know, I don't want to take any direction or instruction from anybody else. I just want to, like, you know, do my own thing and blah, 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 blah. That's not how religion works. Okay. Religion is necessarily hierarchical, received, and it's not something that you just kind of drum up out of nowhere. You don't just kind of like sit there like with your legs crossed and sort of just wait for, you know, the inspiration to strike. It's something that you have to work at. It's something that actually takes quite a lot of study. At least for us, it does, because our ancestral traditions have been broken.
Yeah, real quick, I would also, you know, what you're saying here, I just want to say, is music to my ears. I've been yelling this for years, and I just want to read to you the title of Tristan's article in Episys 1. It talks about this.
Which it's, I'm sure our friend Truyan will be putting into the comment section as we speak.
Yeah. The title of this article that he wrote is On the Need for Theistic Paganism, Doctrine and Hierarchy, or Against the Murderous Thieving Hordes of Wiccans. It's yes. All about that. It was one of the best articles written about this topic that you're talking about. So I'm sorry to interrupt, but what you're talking about now is a big thing that we like to talk about here in the Bog. It's something that we advocate for very strongly in Nerona society.
Yeah, definitely. And I won't like harp on it too much, but I do want to emphasize it. I think I've seen Tristan and Kerwin talk on the Survive the Jive Facebook page a few times about this wonderful phrase called cultural Protestantism. Yeah. And I think it's a great concept. It's something that like needs to be more widely understood. And the idea of Protestantism is every man his own king, every man sort of like, don't tell me what to do. Kind of like, you know, soli fide, right? Like by scripture alone.
Yeah.
Right. Like it's the sort of abstracted individual, just kind of like, you know, with a relationship between himself and God.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, you need the tradition. You need the hierarchy. You need the theological structure. You can't just kind of make it up as you go along, kind of thing. So anyway, well, with that,
as yeah. I actually make the argument in the article here, if there wasn't a correct way of doing things, a correct way to believe a specific doctrine and an understanding of the religion, then we wouldn't have priests, would we? Everyone would be a priest.
And I mean, in all Indo-European cultures at all times and places, there was a priestly caste, there was a priestly hierarchy, and it acted as a sort of conduit between the society between the human and divine societies. So I just wanted to emphasize that and say that you definitely need that. But, however, at the same time, we have to understand kind of where this don't tell me what to do business came from. And I think where that came from is the sort of de-emphasis of European paganisms on doctrine, right? They are more orthopraxic than they are orthodox. They're more about practice than they are about belief. So when people say, don't tell me what to believe, and pagans are saying that, that's not coming from nowhere. I think that's something that's coming from, it's distorted, it's horrifically distorted, but it's a distorted version of them saying it's all about practice more than belief. Now, this is not to say that belief doesn't matter. I mean, there's a term in the Latin that basically means religious scruple or attitude towards worship, and it's a very important concept, and it might sound familiar. It's called religio, right? This is where we get the term religion from. And what it is, it describes an attitude towards your praxis, which you need. It's not like if you're an actor on a stage and you just act out the rites. That's not the same as being a religious celebrant that actually means it. You do have to have it in your heart. You have to believe it. But what really, really matters is the praxis. It's the actual rite. It's the ritual, the steps, the things that you do have to be correct. You have to be very, very particular about these things, very meticulous and conscientious about actually getting the rites correct, which is something that this is the one thing that's maybe the hardest thing to reconstruct out of Proto-Indo-European theology is the ritual. And that's something that I personally have been very, very engaged in. And I haven't really published anything about it or whatever, but it's something that it's very important to me. But one of the things that kind of ties in with that is that what is at the root of all of this, what is sort of even behind the mythology, I would say, in the Indo-European mythic complex, is the ancestor cult. And what that is, basically, it's the veneration of one's ancestors, obviously. Mm-hmm. And this is something that gets passed down from father to son, through families, through the generations, and they're particular to a family. So these are the rites that you are received. They're received from the ancestors. And it serves an important function as well. It serves an important social function to sort of connect people through time. You know, there's an interesting quote by Chesterton, and I'm going to completely bungle it here, but it goes something like, you know, if we really wanted to be democratic, we would give a vote to the dead, right? Like, that's the most democratic thing of all, is to give a vote to our ancestors. And that's really what the ancestor cult's all about, is it's not just remembering the ancestors, it's keeping them present to you as spirits that are with you in a very visceral sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely critical to the Germanic understanding of religion. You know, we celebrate the ancestors in Aufablot. They are the honored Aufarch. And, you know, that's something that's really special. You have to keep it into your mind when you're thinking about what do I do, what do I think about, what do I think about religiously, that our ancestors have, you know, thousands and thousands of thousands of years of inbuilt religious tradition, ways, values, cultural traditions, and beliefs about how the reality functioned, society worked, you know, the relations between man and woman and man and society, man and man even. And we can look back to what our ancestors believed, to live what they lived, how they lived their lives, and what they would think as a direct religious experience for how we should conduct ourselves today.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, even just from an epistemic point of view, what a tradition is it's essentially thousands and thousands of man hours of experience rolled up into a sort of into one. So it's, you know, old people, like people in generations past, were very, very smart, and they had their experiences were not all that different from our own, and it's something that we need to take on board. Like, you know, the wisdom of the ancestors is extremely important, but more than that, it's something, the veneration of ancestors connects us with our deep past. And this is something that we absolutely can't forget. Like, as pagans, I mean, why would you take on a religion that has, where the tradition has been broken for so long, if you didn't have this awe, this veneration for your own ancestors, the people that came before you? And the ancestor cult is the way to do that. So it is very Indo-European, if I'm going to borrow a phrase. It's probably the most Indo-European thing to engage in the ancestor cult. Like many ancient peoples, I mean, the Indo-Europeans believed that when the body died, the soul would continue on and survive in some form. But they didn't really believe in a sort of like heaven, at least not in the archaic stage. They believed that the dead person continued to live underground, rooted to the soil. And the rootedness in the soil makes all the difference. So not only was the dead man tied to the soil, but he also like kept his corporeal form, basically. He was still embodied, which is also important theologically. Like, the soul and the body were never quite separated, and not even in death. Death didn't even part them. So the rites of sepulture were very important, and they're still important to us today. I mean, we still bury our dead. So when the man died, his family would bury him, and it was usually, at least in classical times, it was usually in a family tomb, like a communal grave. And here we can see the sort of the barrows of the Germanic peoples as a parallel with that. And the dead man was always alive and present to his family. Like, they would actually feed him and give him libations and offer worship to the dead man. And what better way to keep the past alive? What better way to have a connection with your ancestors than if you talk to them every single day? So the dead were considered present. They were present to the family and rooted in the soil. Above all, the dead man was tied to a particular place, a particular property. So this is where I think the rootedness in the soil is where we get so many different things in terms of Native European theology. The Native European soul is very rooted, I think. And it's also where we get our love of even something so prosaic as property, right? Like where do we get our obsession with property rights? I mean, it's something that I think is quite particular to Europeans. And this is one of the places where it kind of grows out of.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you mentioned about property rights. You can go back and you can look. And it's not, when you hear property rights, you usually think you're going to hear a whole bunch of libertarian stuff coming up. But property rights is a theme that's been going back all the way. You know, you could read about the old Norse and their disputes and their rituals and their ceremonies surrounding property. They, you know, you look at they had land naming ceremonies and all this kind of stuff dedicated to naming and being attached to property. It wasn't just like I own this property. It was you had a spiritual relationship with property over many, many generations. It was a very important concept, and it ties into the Saxon laws, ties into, I believe there's a passage in it in the Frisian laws. It's a recurring theme. So I completely agree. I think that it's property rights is not just a tradition of law among Indo-Europeans, but is a spiritual tradition as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And we even have good reason to believe that go ahead.
I was just going to say to go back to what you were saying about the ancestor cult, I dug up here one of my favorite quotes delivered from a Scythian king to the Persians when they were having a war. And he says, "If you Persians desire to fight us Scythians, mind that we have here graves of our fathers. Find them and try to destroy them, and you will know whether we will fight for those graves or not."
Yeah, that's a perfect encapsulation of the whole thing, right? Like, when you're tied to the soil, when you're tied to a particular place, when you're defending your ancestors, you're not just defending your children and your family, you're defending your family all the way back. It takes on an even more intensive sort of import, right? And this kind of thing was just so important to ancient peoples, and it's not something that really gets talked about nearly as much as other aspects of paganism, but I think it's what's at the bottom of all of it. Like, here's an example. So there's an anecdote from like later Greek history, and I forget what the name of the guy is, but there was an Athenian general who was victorious and led his troops to victory in a sea battle. He's like this heroic figure, sort of like maybe like a Winston Churchill kind of guy, right? The kind of person who's like looking forward to a triumph when he goes back to his native city after this victory. But here's the thing. In the course of winning the battle, a few of his men are lost at sea, right? You know, and he's not really that pious of a man, right? He's probably taught by a philosopher or something like that. He didn't really believe in the old superstitions about burial and ancestor worship and the worship of the hearth and all that. So he doesn't go back, and doesn't bother to go recover the dead soldiers. I mean, they're just lifeless bodies kind of like bobbing around in the open ocean like ice cubes or something. But to the Greek, and especially to the conservative Greek, the sort of like, you know, Cato the Elder type figure, but in the Greeks, this was a horrific, horrific sacrilege. Unthinkable, really. And yeah, I mean, like, in doing this, he condemned...
Even in the Iliad, they take a truce for both sides to collect their dead without harm.
Yeah, because they understand, like, in the Iliad, the Trojans and, the Achaeans, they share a cultural complex, and they know that if you don't collect the dead and if you don't bring and bury this person, you don't bring them back to their native land, I mean, they could condemn countless ancestors to a form of damnation. This person would be like a hungry ghost forever. Nobody to celebrate his obsequies. Nobody to feed him wine or food or give him gifts or anything. All the stuff that you would do in the ancestor cult. And do you know what they do with this general, this victorious general, this Winston Churchill guy? They put him to death. They put him to death, even though he won this crucial battle that probably saved thousands of people. They put him to death because he didn't have any respect for that at all. And that was so important to the ancient Greeks. So this just gives you an idea of how important it was, the ancestor cult.
Among the Hindus, they have the religious holiday of Pitru Paksha.
That's right.
And part of the religious function there is they ritualistically feed and water the dead, their dead ancestors. And they believe that you will only receive the sustenance in the afterlife that you have given to your own ancestors in life. So if you were stingy and didn't give your ancestors food and water and wine and all that sort of stuff, you won't get it.
Yeah, there's a sort of do ut des thing, which is a Roman formula that means I give so that you should give. It's a gift cycle type thing, which is another very, very important concept in pagan religions. There's a reciprocity to the ancestor cult. You know that in celebrating your ancestors, you yourself will become a celebrated ancestor at some point. And it just, what it does is it establishes an unbreakable bond between past, present, and future. And this is the sort of thing that we have lost over time. There are some vestiges of it in later Christian practice, but for the most part, it was sort of severed. And now we're seeing the result of the severance of the past. I mean, just look out there. What's going on today? People are toppling statues. People are trying to erase the past. People are trying to make a clean break.
If you really want to get yourself scared at night, just try to imagine what our ancestors think of modern society.
Oh, yeah.
The wrath that they must hold in their hearts.
Well, we could even consider what's going on as a sort of punishment for their neglect. I think that really is what's going on.
There's the quote, do not look for a punishment for modernity is itself the punishment.
It is, and it's a horrific punishment. I mean, most people are living pretty good lives right now. Everybody's kind of pretty well fed, and, you know, life is not that hard. It's not hard at all, but it's going to get pretty goddamn hard pretty soon, and that's something that it's really blackpilling to think about, but the bulwark against this, the thing that's, if it does come, if there's some sort of a systemic collapse, the thing that's going to survive on the other side of it is going to be something like the hearth cult. It's going to be a small group of people that have this tie between them that is just completely unbreakable, right? It's the whole, this is the whole analogy of the fasces, right? That lies behind fascism. It's the bundle of sticks that is unbreakable together, that as individuals is just completely fragile, right? This is kind of where that comes from, right? I mean, it's an Indo-European symbol. So, yeah, I would say that the hearth cult, the ancestor cult, is something that deserves more attention. And it's actually something that is the book that I was talking about earlier, The Ancient City, which is that book that explains developments in Greek and Roman history through Indo-European lens. This is what it's saying. Basically, it's the hearth cult, the ancestor cult is kind of what's the driving force behind all of it.
And I will quote from my favorite book, Culture of the Teutons, here about this topic. Wilhelm Grönbeck says, "In former times, the solitary had no possibilities. His ideas, even though amounting to genius, would perish just as he himself perished, leaving no trace. The fir that stands alone decays, neither bark nor leaf cloth it," says the Havamal, "and the words bear this literal meaning, that the tree which stands alone in the field can only fade. It uses all its force to delay the decomposing action of wind and rot a little while. The individual could not exist save as a thrall or a nithing, in whom only the animal part of human life remained, and barely that. A freedman was the imperfect creature he was because he had not properly any clan. The man of family is free because he stands in the fence of kin. He has no weight crushing him from above. It is otherwise with the freedman. He stands alone and therefore must have a power above him.
Right. Yeah, no, exactly. And this connection to the past, this sort of corporate identity, this, you know, thinking of society as a body that's held together by a thread, you know, by the hearth, by the cult of the ancestors. This is pretty much like if you wanted to have the polar opposite of liberalism, the thing that like liberalism cannot integrate no matter what, it would be something like this, right? Because liberalism is the abstracted individual sort of,
atomized individualism.
Exactly. And this is the opposite of that. This is the ancestor cult is the idea that you are not an individual at all. Like, this is something that is completely antithetical to the view of the individualist view. Like, the ancient Greeks did not, and Romans, they did not have an idea of the individual. The closest that they come to having an individual, they didn't have a word for it, right? The closest they come would be idiotes, which is, I mean, you can kind of even just hear in that what they would have thought about such a thing, right? This is sort of the loner, right? The person that doesn't really associate with other men quite as much as he should, the idiotes. But yeah, so the ancient peoples, pagans. My background is more in like classical languages, so I'm not as familiar with the Germanic side of things. But from what I know in the classical world, there really was no individual to speak of at all. And under liberalism, it seems like basically the sovereign individual is kind of like, it's just getting more and more sovereign all the time. You know, maybe one day your gender changes every day, just like an outfit. And it's like, I mean, this would have been utterly unthinkable to ancient peoples, right? And it's the antidote. It's the antidote to all that, is this corporate connection between modern and ancient. And I think the hearth is an important symbol for that as well, because you've got the fire of the hearth, right? And there's a great quote by someone. I think it's Mahler, the 19th century composer. And it goes, tradition isn't the worship of ashes, it's the preservation of fire.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And this is a perfect symbol for our archaic Indo-European, right? He's the ideal traditionalist. His mode of worship essentially guarantees his traditionalism. He's not an individual. He's just a link in an endlessly long chain reaching back through the mists of time. And the ancestor cult, ultimately, he would trace his lineage back to a god. Most of them would. So on the hearth, he'd keep a fire burning day and night without interruption. There'd be some special circumstances and ceremonies where he would extinguish it and then relight it immediately. But the fire was, for him, like a sort of deity, right? It's coextensive with the ancestors. And the idea of the eternal flame that just burns on and on for thousands of years, this is a potent symbol for everything that's the antithesis of what we see today.
Excellent.
No, I mean, it's entirely the same within the Germanic culture. And I try to take pains to explain this to people because it's so strikingly different from modern liberalism that people just, you know, people default to it because it's what they've grown up with. They don't really think about it. It's not something that it was ever explicitly taught to them as a concrete thing. It's just, you know, picked up through cultural osmosis. So it's very difficult to get people to understand that this isn't the way it works in the actual religious faith and the culture of our forefathers. That, you know, the Germanic people believed in a perception of the self that almost seems what we would today consider to be Eastern. They had an emphasis upon a clan or a family before they ever considered themselves an individual.
Yeah, for sure. But in a way, like, the individual didn't come from nowhere as well. Like, you know, one of the things I think that people really get wrong, especially when they're, discussing politics and thinking about, how we should live and where we are at, is a lot of times people are just like, no, well, we've just made a mistake at some point. Like, you know, we decided to become individuals. And it's like, nothing like that ever happens by accident. It's like I was saying before about how the sort of pagan that's like, don't tell me what to do, don't tell me what to worship, is like, that didn't come from nowhere. That comes out of the orthopraxis over orthodoxy thing. And I think that the individual itself is actually something that can be traced back to the step, essentially. And this might seem a little strange, but stay with me here on this. So one of the things about the domestic cult is that, about the ancestor cult, it was also called a domestic cult because it was particular to a household, right? Like, you wouldn't worship somebody else's ancestors. That was just like, not only was that kind of like, well, why would you do that? But these people did not want to share their gods, essentially, right? Like, it was like the anti-proselytizing type religion. Like, not only would you not sort of like encroach upon someone else's theological beliefs, it's like you would try and you wouldn't want them to have your ancestors, because that's your source of power, right? Like, you wouldn't want your enemy to have.
Not only are you not allowed to worship my ancestors are going to ensure that we kick your ass.
Exactly, right? So these things are like, they were particular to a clan or a household or a tribe, right? And this is something that really underscores an important part about Indo-European theology. And it's something we were talking before in the, like, you know, before we started about Evola. I think it's something that actually that Evola, for all that he gets right, is something that he gets wrong, is that it's Indo-European theology is anti-universalist, right? Each house has its own fire, its own ancestors, its own gods, its own rites, its own worship. And the domestic cult, each domestic cult is completely distinct from others, right? There's a thread that sort of unites one household to another. And that is the clan structure that we can kind of go into if we have time. But in the earliest phase, each household was like this discrete social unit, completely autonomous. And the last, yeah, like I said, the last thing that any family wants to do is share its gods. And this is sort of like alien to our modern theology, which is totally universalist. But at the same time, you can kind of see here the sort of like the just the early beginnings of the individual, right? Because each house, the individual isn't a person, though. The individual is a family, right? Like, that's the right. Discrete social unit.
I mean,
and that's,
in using the Roman concept, we would call it a pater familias, and the Germanic people used it as a manus, I believe the term was. Manus, it derives from the term for a hand.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was basically the head of the family, the head of the clan, acting in proxy for the entirety of the clan. And he could do a thing, and it wasn't just him doing it. It was being possessed, ergleafed by the spirit of the clan to act in their stead, all as one, as a single unit.
That's right, yeah. And I know we're coming up to the hour mark, so just tell me to shut up if you want. But I think it's important to maybe go into a little bit about this house father here. The paterfamilias, he's the big cheese, right? Like, so he's the head of the family, and he's at the same time he's the high priest, so he's the one that conducts the rites. He's also the supreme justice of his family, and he's the sole proprietor, and that comes back to the whole ownership thing, right? The best way to think of him is as the king of his own castle. He's like this little absolute monarch in his house that rules with impunity, and nobody can tell him how to perform his rites. He's the only one that is fit to administer them. He's the absolute religious authority. He even has the power of life and death. At least in classical times, he had the power of life and death over his family, right? Like, he could put, if you were, there's actually an interesting anecdote about a Roman consul. Senator. He's a Roman senator named Cassius. And, you know, he's an adult, obviously. He's a senator. But he was still under the manus, the hand of his father, right? And he did something, I forget what it was, some transgression. And his father decided, well, no, I'm sorry, son. I'm going to have to put you to death. So he threw him from the Tarpeian Rock, the senator, right? His father did this. And this just goes to show you what the power of the father was in ancient times. So anyway, he's got the power of life and death over his family, and he's the one that is the sole proprietor of the inheritance, right? His family is essentially a form of property that goes with him.
His children don't own anything. Everything that we would consider today, like, I own, I went to work, I bought money, I bought a house, I bought a car. In ancient times, you might have possession of it, but technically this all belongs to the paterfamilias.
That's right. Even the children, even, like, you know, all the family members are his property, right? But in a way, they're not his property. Well, I mean, it's complicated, right? Because the property was actually inalienable, so he would not be able to sell his plot of land. The house father, this absolute monarch, was at least restrained in that sense, right? Because how could you sell your plot of land? That's where all the ancestors are buried. And this sort of goes to show you. So what I was going to say is that the house father is sort of the archetype, the sort of ancient sort of prototype of the individual, right? The sovereign individual, the king of his own castle, the man you can't tell. I mean, you can't tell him what to do. You can't tell him how to perform his rights. But at the same time, he's not absolutely limited. He does have a sovereign that stands above him, and that's the line of ancestors that goes back into the deep mists of time. So he's not the sovereign individual of the modern day. He still has to, like, he would not think to deviate from the rights that he's received from his father and his father's father all the way back. This is something that the religio, the religious scruple, the sort of internal attitude towards your rights, this is why that's just so important and totally ineliminable. So we have here a kind of like prototype of the sovereign individual of modernity, but it's tempered by some very important things that we've kind of lost. And really, the main thing that we've lost is the ancestor cult, I would say.
Excellent. Man, what an excellent discussion tonight. But unfortunately, Mr. Mike, we do got to shut it down. We are over an hour. But I'd love to have you come back on and talk more. Really, really brilliant guy. Everybody make sure to go over to imperiumpress.org and check this guy out. Do you have anywhere else that folks can check you out at?
The only other social media that I've got right now for the company is our Twitter, which is at Imperium Press. So head on over to imperiumpress.org. Right now, we're giving everything away for free in ebook format. We've got 4 books out. We're a new publisher. 4 books out. They're all available for free in ebook format while COVID is happening, so that, you know, people aren't sitting bored at home with nothing to do. You can at least have something to read. So go download everything. If you want, you can buy a hard copy. That would really help us out so that we can keep putting things out. Join up with our mailing list, because we've got lots coming. So go onto the website, join up with the mailing list, and give us a follow on Twitter at imperiumpress.org. And, you know, we're tweeting spicy takes on things all the time, so it's worth it.
Excellent. Very, very cool. All right, Mr. Mike, if you don't mind, stick around. I'd like to talk to you after the show's over. But Mr. Tristan, do you have anything in conclusion?
You know, not really. I would just say that, you know, would love to have you back on. The hour went extremely quickly, and I know we had a whole bunch of other topics we planned on getting to, but we could do it another time.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thanks for having me on, guys. And give me the word. We'll do it again.
Absolutely. All right, folks. Make sure you follow me here on DLive.tv/Dave Martell, which The Bog is live every single Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern. You can check me out over on YouTube. Go check out the YouTube channel, Dave Martell. Also, go check out the Neurona Society's YouTube channel. Just type in Neurona Society. You can find it there. Go to Neurona.org. Go to ariakasha.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Big Dave Martell. Gabin Mines at Dave Martell. I don't really use that stuff, but I'm about to pull the plug altogether and get myself out of the servile form to the mechanurge and be a free man in nature once again very soon. But yeah, check me out on all of those platforms. We've got much more coming out. Everybody stay tuned. Epicist issue 3 coming out on the 20th. You guys are going to love this issue. It's going to be really, really great. And on top of that, Neurona Society just released The Aether book. So check that out. The Aether book. The AEETARBOK. The Aether book. It's over on the Neurona Society Amazon account. So I'll see you guys next week. on the bog Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern. I got to shut this down, man. My studio is like 150 degrees. So anyway, I'll check you guys next week. Hail the gods. Hail the folk. Hail victory. Many blessings. Everybody stay safe. Stay healthy. I'll see you next time.